WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
When an American woman dislikes her thighs, says Joan Jacobs Brumberg, she's unlikely to like herself. Brumberg writes about girls and self-image in the new book, The Body Project. She says that many girls today base their individual identities on the shape and appearance of their bodies. As the emphasis on looks has intensified, the ideal body has become more impossible to achieve. As part of her research, Brumberg compared the diaries of girls today with the diaries of girls since 1830. Her previous book, Fasting Girls, was a history of anorexia nervosa. Brumberg teaches women's history and women's studies at Cornell University. One day she was talking with her students about the corsets women wore in earlier eras. The students were appalled, but then they started sharing their own body grooming habits. I asked Brumberg to tell us about the conversation they had.
Well, in the course of talking about grooming today and the ways in which they cope with their bodies today, they started telling me about the bikini line area, which was a euphemism, of course, for genitals, and the fact that they either pluck pubic hair or use some kind of cream or waxing procedure to get rid of it. And I posed to them and to myself the question of whether or not this represented progress, or what did it represent? To be this involved in care and grooming of the body. So it seemed to me that although my students were very upset about corsets and understood all the cultural constraints that the corset represented, they hadn't really thought about the kinds of constraints that they operated under.
And you've concluded that today's beauty imperatives are in some ways more constraining than old corsets were.
Well, I think in many ways they are, because they've moved really, if you think about it, from the external to the internal. In the 19th century, most young women were very focused on their internal character and how it was reflected in their outward behavior. In the 20th century, the emphasis is on developing internal controls, you know, such as dieting or body sculpting, all of it to shape our outward appearance. And I believe that in the course of the 20th century, the pressures on the body have escalated rather than declined, and that that has particular consequence for young girls in the process of development.
And related to that, you've concluded that body image is more wrapped up in personal identity than ever before.
Yes.
We are how we look.
Absolutely. And I think you can really hear it in the voices of girls in their adolescent diaries as they change over time.
And a lot of your research is based on diaries that you've collected of adolescent girls from the 1830s to the 1990s. And in fact, there's a couple of journal excerpts I want you to read, one from the 1800s and one from the 1980s, that offers a terrific contrast.
Well, the first one is a adolescent diarist in the 1890s. Interestingly enough, these are both New Year's resolutions. New Year's resolutions give historians like me a wonderful opportunity to see what's on the mind of girls. This girl said, "Resolved not to talk about myself or feelings, to think before speaking, to work seriously, to be self-restrained in conversation and actions, not to let my thoughts wander, to be dignified, interest myself more in others." The contrasting resolution, written in 1982, really captures the transition that I'm writing about. And this diarist, who was actually a student at Stuyvesant High School in New York City, wrote, "I will try to make myself better in any way I possibly can with the help of my budget and babysitting money. I will lose weight, get new lenses, already got new haircut, good makeup, new clothes, and accessories." So I think the contrast between the two really captures how girls today feel about themselves.
Yeah, so what do these two journal entries say to you?
Well, they're very distinct, I think, in terms, again, of this this change between character and looks. What I've I've called it the change from good looks, I'm sorry, from good works to good looks. And today, the body is at the center of a girl's developmental process. The body is something to be managed and maintained. Girls give special attention to its exterior surfaces, skin, hair, contours, more so than ever before. And the body has become the source of identity. And if you notice in the second quotation, the upkeep of the body through purchases played out in the marketplace are very critical to this young woman's sense of herself.
From your reading of diaries of girls from the 18th, from the 19th and 20th centuries, and from your research into advertising over the years, when do you see dieting and, you know, being slim becoming an obsession?
Well, I dealt with this a little bit in an earlier book of mine, and I think it would be fair to say that at the end of the 19th century, there was a certain very small elite set of girls who wanted to be slim for spiritual purposes. In other words, having a thin body meant that you were not connected to any carnal desires, such as eating or sexuality. But dieting as we know it, dieting by women and girls, what was called initially slimming, is really a development of the late teens and early 1920s. And in my book, I've got a wonderful diary by a woman by the name of Yvonne Blue, growing up in Chicago in the 1920s. And it's quite interesting because no one in her family understood what a calorie was. that concept was new.
But the discovery was pretty new, huh?
Yeah. And in addition, they didn't have a home scale. Most people didn't have home scales. I mean, you know, before home scales, women's lives were quite different. Yvonne Blue had to go to the University of Chicago or to a local drugstore to weigh herself. And she and one of her girlfriends got into a little contest about who was going to lose the most weight. And, of course, this is the 20s, and they want to wear a slinky little chemise dress. They bob their hair. They want to look different than their Victorian mothers. And dieting really becomes a feature of female culture, of women's culture, in the 20s. And also you begin to see in the 20s some of the major newspapers, like the Chicago Tribune, have a editor who includes dieting information now under the rubric of beauty culture.
So we have the discovery of the calorie. We have the availability of home scales to weigh yourself on,
right,
and clothes that are more revealing of the body shape.
Absolutely. And one of the other things that I'm interested in is increasing opportunities for self-scrutiny across the 20th century. One of the things that I talk about, and I've thought about a lot, is the introduction of mirrors. But, you know, in the 19th century, a looking glass was a luxury item in the homes, really, of only the wealthiest people. At the end of the 19th century, by the 1880s, 1890s, you can see in the Sears and Roebuck catalog, for example, the availability of mass-produced hand mirrors. You begin to see in the early department stores opportunities for young girls to look at themselves on department store counters and in dressing rooms. And of course, movies have an enormous impact on young women because movie stars are not only role models, but the film process itself suggests that the image, one's image, is malleable. So if a young woman went to the movies in the 1920s and saw the same film star, somebody like Betty Bronson. One day she's Peter Pan. A week later she's a pirate. A week later she's an Indian princess. They begin to think about the possibility of changing their own image as well. And I think the ultimate expression or symbol of the popularization or the acceptability of self-scrutiny is something like the compact. You know that little mirror? You know what I'm talking about.
The handheld mirror that accompanies a lot of makeup, like blush
exactly.
on or powder base.
Exactly. Well, those are popularized in the 1920s.
Mm-hmm.
And by the end of the 20s, Ladies' Home Journal has a picture of a young woman applying makeup using a compact on the street. Well, 30 years before, this would not have been something that a nice woman would have done. Number one, worn makeup, but number two, been so invested in her appearance in public. So there is a connection between self-scrutiny and also this notion that femininity, modern femininity, requires a certain kind of vanity.
Well, I'm very interested in your research into the mirror because I know, for instance, when I'm staying at a hotel, I tend to become much more self-conscious because usually the bathroom in a hotel is lined with mirrors.
You're waiting for the elevator.
There's a big mirror on the outside of the elevator. Then the inside of the elevator is a big mirror, too. There's another mirror waiting for you in the lobby. And you're constantly staring at yourself and noticing things about your teeth you never knew existed before and so on. You know, it's just a very self-conscious kind of experience.
Well, I think from a historical perspective, that's what's happened over the course
right.
of the 20th century. If you think about it, I mean, we've moved from because of new hygienic concerns, we are concerned about our teeth. We are concerned about our odors, menstrual odors, body odors. We're concerned about the size and shape of our bodies. And many of these concerns are now merged with health concerns. So middle-class parenting in the 20th century has required greater investments in girls, in dermatology offices, in orthodonture, contact lenses, I could go on, weight loss camps, maybe now even liposuction.
My guest is Joan Jacobs Brumberg. She teaches women's history and women's studies at Cornell, and she's author of the new book, The Body Project, An Intimate History of American Girls. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Joan Jacobs Brumberg. She teaches women's history and women's studies at Cornell and is the author of the new book, The Body Project, An Intimate History of American Girls. Her previous book was on eating disorders. In looking at the history of girls' feelings about their bodies and self-image, you spend a lot of time talking about the onset of menstruation. And one of the points you make is that menstruation, on the average, begins a few years earlier for girls today than it did, say, 100 years ago. How does that figure in, do you think, to self-image?
Well, I think it's a very important part of the problem today with self-image. Earlier sexual maturation is not in and of itself a bad thing. In fact, it's a symbol of our affluence. It has to do with, you know, improved nutrition and the decline of infectious diseases. But if you have earlier sexual maturation without a parallel escalation in cognitive and emotional development, then the kind of culture in which these early maturing girls find themselves becomes very important. And if, in fact, the culture offers them no particular supports or any particular kind of nurturance, then I think these girls find themselves in some difficulty, particularly in a culture that exacerbates adolescent self-consciousness and encourages precocious sexuality, like ours.
There have historically been a lot of restraints on young girls and women in that period between the onset of menstruation and marriage, constraints to make sure that the girl was chaste.
Right. Chastity belts.
Yeah, chastity belts. And then after that, chaperones and
right.
curfews and
right.
very strict
right.
parents and, you know, social taboos and so on. And a lot of that is gone now. And I'm sure you'd say that that's a good thing. You know, I mean, who wants the chastity belts or, and in many cases, the chaperones? But with a lot of freedom has become, you know, I guess we've gotten a lot of problems, too. Talk to us a little bit about some of the trade-offs you think that girls coming of age face today between, you know, having new freedom but also having increased responsibility and difficulty.
Well, I think you've said it very well. I mean, there are trade-offs. This is not simple. Sexual liberalism has consequences for adolescent girls, and sexual liberalism without a feminist base can be dangerous for girls. And that's something that feminists like myself need to come to terms with, that the that sexual expression in adolescence, which I support and many people support, is not an end-all and be-all. It is not the ultimate value in adolescence. I can think of other rights that I think are equally essential for adolescent girls, such as the right to be heard in school. In other words, I think that we have to prepare girls better for the full range of sexual pressures and sexual choices that are available in the 1990s. I mean, at the end of the 20th century, most of our girls get sexual information either from popular culture, I call that the entertainment model of sex education, or they get lectured about abstinence, just say no, that model. I don't go for either one of them. I think we've got to really start talking between the generations about something that I'm going to call sexual ethics. And by that I mean some kind of real discussion about what's fair and equitable in the realm of the intimate for girls, putting an emphasis on safety, on reciprocity, on responsibility.
Let me ask you, it seems to me we all assume that it's adolescent girls and young women who have the real body image problems in America, that they're obsessed with their bodies, that their identity comes from, you know, cosmetic things. I think that this is not something that you necessarily outgrow. And I'm wondering if you're interested in looking at middle-aged women.
Well, I think you're... Why do you think I got into this? Self-consciousness.
Oh, okay.
Of course. I don't think that we outgrow this kind of socialization. There's a lot of evidence around that American women suffer from something that's called by some therapists bad body fever. In other words, this continuous internal commentary on the body that constitutes a rather powerful form of self-punishment. A lot of psychologists use tests now of body esteem and body dissatisfaction as measures of women's mental health. I think it's an extraordinary brain drain. I've written about it in my earlier book, Fasting Girls, which was a history of anorexia nervosa. I've tried to make the case in that book that, you know, this kind of attention to beauty is a bad long-term investment. But what I've realized now in the case of adolescent girls is that bad body fever, or this distaste for one's own body, really empowers male desire. Girls who don't feel good about themselves are more susceptible to flattery, to manipulation, even to abuse. You know, if you want to be wanted so much, then you are vulnerable. And I think that kind of problem continues with women throughout their lifetime.
Joan Jacobs-Brumberg is the author of The Body Project. She teaches women's studies and women's history at Cornell University.